Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Agent of Influence podcast. I'm your host, Nabil Hannan, Field Chief Information Security Officer at NetSpy, a leader in offensive security. In this podcast, we discuss life as a security leader and the challenges and opportunities that accompany the job. Listen to our past episodes at www.netspy.com/agentofinfluence or wherever you listen to podcasts. Today, we're joined by Neil Plotnick. Hi, Neil.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you.
Neil is the cybersecurity teacher at Everett High School in Massachusetts. Fun fact, in 2016, Neil was one of 213 mathematics and science teachers awarded the Presidential Award for Excellence in Mathematics and Science Teaching from President Obama. And last year, he was awarded the Cyber Educators of the Year Award by cyber.org. He's also the founder of Cybersecurity Educators Group on Facebook, a community of more than 1,500 influencers and educators in the space that seeks to share curriculum and tips related to cybersecurity education. So Neil, it's an honor for us to have you as a guest and talk to you today and learn as much as we can from you. Before we get started, we like to get to know our guests a little better on the personal level with a round of rapid-fire questions. So if you're ready, we can get started.
Fire away.
Question number one, Apple or Android?
Apple.
Do you have a favorite Apple device?
Well, I have my iPhone. My wife got an iPhone a bunch of years ago. I had an Android. She says, why don't we use the same thing between both of us? So I said, okay. So I've been stuck with the Apple phone ever since.
Awesome. What's the most used app on your phone? And let's not just say text messaging or email.
Probably listening to music. I either through Spotify or XM radio.
Great. What would you say is the best lesson you learned from your first ever job?
I worked at a computer store and my best friend worked at a stereo seller. And he said to me, when you have a client who buys something from you, best thing to do is call them up 2 days later and ask them, how are things going? Because invariably, there's always a question they're going to have, like, I can't do this, I can't do that. And when you demonstrate that you care enough to ask them, usually it's an easy question to solve, that's going to be a great next sale because they're going to show off the new computer to whoever bought it and say, hey, look, you got to get it from this guy because he helped me out and he knows his stuff and he cares. And he said, when they're buying something, they could buy from anybody, but if they're buying it, it's because they like you. So that was the advice I got from my first real job in the computer field.
Sounds like you should be in sales versus teaching, but we'll talk about that another time.
There's a relationship there between sales and teaching. You're always selling something to the kids.
Number four, if you could live anywhere, where would it be?
Oh, gosh. I've been blessed to have traveled. I really loved Norway when I was there. I thought it was a beautiful place to be. Just a very different kind of vibe. Friendly, beautiful, dark in winter. So it might be kind of cool to live there for a while.
Awesome. What would you say is your favorite meal, breakfast, lunch, or dinner?
Breakfast.
Any particular breakfast item that's your favorite?
Usually just simple scrambled eggs, toast, that kind of stuff. With coffee. So just that's to get my day started. It's the one thing that I know I have to plan my day around.
Great. What would you say is your favorite holiday?
I kind of like the 4th of July because it's a holiday. A, it's secular, so everybody gets to celebrate. It was my parents' wedding anniversary. It's my brother's wedding anniversary. It's just summer has just started. So it's a lot of things going for it.
It's definitely a very popular holiday that many people enjoy. So that's true.
If you live in Boston, you got to go to the Boston Pops. And if you go July 3rd for the dress rehearsal, there's only 50,000 people there. It's the same concert, no fireworks, but it's a lot less stress. So good tip.
That is true. What would you say is your passion?
I have a couple of things. I like to jump in the ocean for Special Olympics every year. I'm going to go in a few days. I love basketball. It's a gift I got with growing up in New York with my son that we enjoy. So we go to sporting events a lot as a family.
What was the last thing that you read?
I tend to read a lot of historical novels, things that are about real people and real things. The last book that I really read was A Proving Ground. It's a book by Kathy Kleiman. It's about the ENIAC programmers from the 1940s, all women programmers. And she actually came in and addressed my students here. It was really kind of a thrill for me to have her come in here and talk about the role that women played in computer science.
That does sound really exciting. What would you say is the favorite part about your job?
The favorite part of the job is those kids that get, oh, wow, I learned something today, and get them excited. We had a lesson today on how DHCP works and some of the limitations of it. And they all of a sudden said, oh, that's why our laptops weren't connecting in the classroom tomorrow or whatever during the end of part of the day. And they realized that I wanted to see if they figured out why leasing for 24 hours was a bad thing. And in our environment, yes. And so it made them understand something that was happening through my explanation of how DHCP works. So but you get that throughout the day and other content areas as well. But that they learned something. That's good.
What would you say is the least favorite part of your job?
There's always stuff you have to deal with, it's the hardest thing in the world is to teach a child to be motivated, to care about what you're doing. And that's something that's a struggle that every teacher has in every area. You have to understand that the kids are there because they have to be there, not because they want to be there. And how to instill that there's a purpose to them learning things if they don't see it right away it's a challenge.
Do you have a favorite cybersecurity event or conference?
Well, I like going to the CSTA conferences, the Computer Science Teachers Association. I've been going to their conferences for about 10, 12 years now, both local chapter stuff and the national conferences. Those are always good. I like to say that a computer science teachers, if you compare us to math teachers, there's like a dozen math teachers in the building. There's four people teach geometry, four that teach algebra, etc. There's only like one or two computer science teachers. And a lot of times when you're alone, you have to find those connections to other people. You have to build a group of people who you can ask questions and help you out. And computer science teachers have been that way for a while. We know that we're a kind of a small subset of a small subset. And we have to rely on each other for assistance and support. And that's been very gratifying to me because people do look to me to help them out with cybersecurity stuff. And I look to other people to help me out with other types of things. But that's really what I find is a joyful thing is that as professionals, we tend to rely on each other and give each other support.
Do you have a favorite mentor and why are they your favorite?
In education, I had two of my professors from UMass Boston. I got my master's when I was 40. I was sort of a career changer. And that's what happens sometimes. And Maria Pyawanski was working on her doctorate. And she always said that when you're teaching somebody something, you have to give them multiple ways of understanding, multiple ways of teaching them, and have multiple ways of them demonstrating their knowledge. Because some people can write an essay. Some people can do a visual poster. Some people can do a talk. Some people can make a TikTok video. And you have to validate that everybody has a different way of showing you they know something. And everybody has to have a different way of learning something. And if you're a coach, if you're a teacher, if you're a mentor to somebody, not everybody responds in the same way to the same stimulus. And you have to understand how people learn in different ways and meet them at their level of how they interpret and get information.
Thank you, Neil. That was very helpful. And that's the end of the rapid fire questions, at least. So now we at least know you a little better. So let's get into it. Wanted to talk to you about your experience as an educator and really understanding different techniques that you find as being most effective when you're trying to generate any sort of awareness and interest in the cybersecurity space for your students.
Well, that tends to be the first lesson that I do is called the digital footprint. And it's just to impress upon the students just how many accounts, how many places there are that they're interacting with that has some information about them. So I started off by showing them my keychain, my own personal keychain, because I like using myself as an example because it doesn't threaten them at all. And I see all these little vendor cards from the pharmacies, from the supermarkets, from wherever you shop. And I say, look, I could save 10 cents a pound on a watermelon, but they know what I'm buying. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? And we have the students look at their apps on their phone. And I say, how many email accounts do you have? How many social media accounts do you have? How many places do you shop with on your phone? Even if they're high school students, they're going to have dozens and dozens of these. And then they start listing them out. And they say, gee, I have 70 or 80 accounts that are out there. And I say, you can keep your phone pristine. Nobody ever touches it. You're the only person who accesses it, but you have to trust every one of those companies to keep your data intact. And then they start saying, oh, okay, is that a problem? So I said, okay, let's take a look at what kind of information they gather and see if that's something you'd want them to learn about you. And if that's something that they can market in a sense, you know, they say to them, Gmail from Google, they don't charge you. Amazon, you know, they have some fees there, but if you have an account with a lot of these social media companies, they're not taking money from you. An account from Facebook doesn't cost anything. So what are they selling? They're selling your information, especially for young kids. If you're 16, 18 years old, you have another 50, 60 years of buying stuff. And that's something where that's marketing gold. And they have to impress upon them that that information about you is precious, and you should have some sense of how pervasive it is and how do you protect yourself. And that's why I started with the digital footprint.
Do students at that age truly understand the broader implication of their data being shared across the internet, across various organizations, and why that may be a negative?
Well, I go back to one of my students several years ago, and she said, "Mr. Plotnick, you're scaring me." And I said, "Good." Because, you know, in the same sense, if they're in a women's health class and they learn about all these diseases, we have a women's health class, and she said, you know, "I learned about diseases and the problems of pregnancy and yada, yada, yada." And I said, that's not trying to scare you, to make you aware of what can go wrong if you don't take care of yourself, what can go wrong if you practice certain types of things as young people tend to do. And I say, that's the kind of thing I want you to be aware of. And then we go into case studies of how people who've had their social media profiles exploited in one form or another. And I say it's a very real problem. We talk about cyberbullying, which has been a very real problem for some of our kids. And so that does make it real to them. I want you to say, you know, if you sort of, you know, you might not ever get into a car accident, but if you don't wear a seatbelt, you're being foolish. So part of my job is to say, here are the seatbelts, here's the helmets, here's the other safety mechanisms that are available to you, so that if you're going to operate in social media and everything else on the internet, that you have some sense of like, where are my off ramps? How do I protect myself? How do I guard against these things from going on?
Do you think the younger generation and the students that you have today are at a disadvantage because their personal information or their pictures may have been shared by their parents on social media, and inadvertently they didn't have a choice in what about them gets shared online until they get access to social media? Their parents, when they have children, within a few minutes, there's pictures and stories and notes about them being born, their names, etc., that go online. Do you feel like students think that that's a disadvantage they have, or are they of the mindset today that they can share whatever on the internet as freely as possible because of trends on TikTok and other social media platforms that encourage the younger generation to actually share more content online?
Going back, I don't think their parents understand what they're doing. It's great to say, kids, you know what happened when your mom put your picture up, there's your birthday. Obviously, when you want to verify your identity with some of these companies that you're doing business with, they're going to say, when's your birthday? So that's why we tell people, hey, if you're going to have any information about you, it can be used to exploit you. The simplest example I tell them is, I don't need to know your username, because a lot of times it's your email address. I just have to guess your password. So I do a whole bunch of lessons on password security, but that's something where, when they look at the vulnerabilities that they're out there, I don't think parents understand what's going on either. I think parents who are not tech savvy think their children are very tech savvy because they grew up with a tablet and a phone. But my own personal viewpoint of these kids is that they don't know other than turning on the phone. They don't really, when I start teaching them how to use a computer, like with Linux and directories and stuff like that, where they really get into understanding how the computer works, they don't know. So I think that's a big fallacy, that people think that tech savvy means you can use apps in your phone, but it's really not designed to teach you how to really things go underneath the hood, so to speak. I mean, you can drive a car very well, but not know anything about how the transmission or the engine works.
I think that's a challenge we have with technology today, is the barrier to usability has gone away. Everything is so much more focused on usability that anyone can pick up a device like an iPad or a tablet or an Android device. And there's lots of things that are intuitive. You touch the things you want to open. You swipe away the things that you want to delete. Whereas before, being tech savvy meant you had to actually learn commands on the command line to be able to perform a function. It wasn't necessarily intuitive. The human-computer interaction piece was something that the human had to learn, whereas now the technology has learned how humans behave, and they have removed that barrier to being able to use the technology, making it more usable. And I think often, to your point, parents and the older generation misinterpret that as someone being more tech savvy versus someone just using something that's easier to use today and intuitive to use today, which may get people in trouble too, because they're making the assumption that you're giving technology to someone that is technologically savvy, whereas they may not understand the implications of their actions, especially if they're doing something online.
I used to work at a Heathkit store, Heath Zenith, down in New York, the mid to late 80s. And we would have customers that bought a brand new computer, and we'd give them some training to get them up to speed on it. And I remember very clearly a family would come in and the kids would say, how do you do that? Okay, great. And the parents were like, why are you doing that? And it was a very different kind of question. They wanted to know, why are you typing in something? How? And the kids just said, let me follow it. Let you sort of like a training a dog or a parrot to like mimic you. And the kids were very easy, like, oh, okay, you have to type in this, type in that. Great, I'll do the same thing. I'll type it and type it that, and I'll make the game do whatever. And the parents were like, this big mysterious computer box, why are you telling it to do these things? And it was sort of a very different kind of message that I saw. And I'm assuming there are plenty of examples of that in today's world. I mean, you see all those commercials for like, you know, the kids come over to see grandma and grandpa. The first they do is they hand them the remote controls. Hey, you have to set these up because I don't know how to use it. You know, my clock's still blinking 12 on my, well, people don't have VCRs anymore, but I think you know what I mean. My microwave oven still says noon.
I have to reprogram that clock on my stove. You know, right. And every time I do, I have to look up how to do it because I have no idea how. I can never remember how that's done. But that happens every time I lose power. That clock goes out of sync with everything else.
True story. I had a customer come into the computer store, asked me this stuff hard to use. I said, well, can you set up your VCR to tape a TV show when you're not home? And they said, well, my radio in my car still says 12 o'clock. And I said, if I can go in and change your clock so it's the right time and put in AM and FM stations, will you buy the computer? He goes, if you can do that, I know you can fix the computer. So yes. And I actually went into this guy's car and set up his clock. So yes, that kind of stuff still, I'm sure, happens today.
So we can keep talking about these stories all day long, and maybe we should do it in person over some beverages. But
sure,
I would
sure.
love to learn a little bit more about your students and the curriculum today and what it looks like. And more so, would love to understand how you envision the curriculum evolving, let's say, in the next 5 years.
So in the cybersecurity world, in terms of high school, middle school, there's a lot of commercial curricula that's available. There's a lot of vendors that produce products that allow you as a non-tech-savvy person, so to speak, to have the kids go to a web portal and follow along and read a lab and click here and click there. So there has been a big push to get some of these things. Now, some of them are free. I mentioned earlier, cyber.org has free K-12 curricula for anybody who's in an American school. And I'm proud to say I've actually submitted some of the lessons that they're using, I think, on NMAP and TCP dump. So they're actually using some of my curricula. I won't mention the name. I went through training for a particular commercial product, and I was using it in my classroom. My school district had been using some of their other products. And I had very smart kids who said, I spent 2 or 3 days going through the lab, clicking where they told me to click, and I have no idea what the hell I did. And that's true for a lot of different content areas. I've taught as a special ed teacher. I have multiple hats. I've taught geometry. I've taught chemistry. I've taught physics. I've taught with other teachers in other content areas. And I see that that's problems. You can give the kid something to read, but they don't have that understanding. So in my own practice, I've made an effort to make the learning as authentic as possible. So I actually have the kids using, they log into a Linux server in my classroom and they run the command line stuff. They actually are doing ping and traceroute, and they're seeing how it operates in real life on a real server. And I think that's very effective. Some of the folks in the cyber worlds, like cyber.org, has now launched a national cyber range, which students can use, and they can actually, through their web browser, use a Kali Linux machine and a Windows computer and run a lot of the tools that come with the Kali Linux. It's a full Kali Linux distribution that they can use, and it's a sandbox. They're not going to hurt anything. That's great. That's the kind of stuff that's really very powerful. Again, there is a learning curve for the teacher, because not many of us who are teaching actually come from an industry background, who actually have the savvy to understand exactly what's going on. And they're sort of just following along with a script. So that, I mean, we understand that you can't get IT people to normally become school teachers. You can't get programmers to become school teachers. There are some many good ones, excellent, really know their stuff. But it becomes a challenge because you have to understand that what you're teaching is not just something you can just pick up reading a book and then be 1 or 2 days ahead of your kids. It really requires a depth of understanding that is a little bit more intense than you might suppose. I guess there's also, I mean, I teach with people with PhDs in chemistry, and they teach chemistry. And their level of understanding is a lot more detailed, a lot more deep than most kids will ever have to use. So my understanding of computers and technology is a lot deeper than the typical kid will be. I have to remind myself, remind my colleagues that a kid takes 4 years of English. Most of them won't be writers or journalists. They take 4 years of math. Most of them won't be accountants or engineers. Same thing in my room. I'm teaching kids cybersecurity. Most of them won't be cyber professionals, but they're all going to use computers in their lives. So by that token, I want them to be armed with at least enough knowledge that they can use their computer responsibly and know what's right and what's wrong. Can they detect a phishing email? Can they help their parents navigate some of these scams that are out there? Can they protect their own information, rely and understand what the CIA triad means with confidentiality? How does that translate to your day-to-day life? Because in virtually every career now, there's going to be computers that are a very big part of what you have to do. And having that knowledge that it becomes ingrained in your DNA, so to speak, is really what I'm trying to impart upon them. The nitty-gritty nuts and bolts stuff, I'm not going to have everybody really get into it, but that's fine. I have to accept that there are kids that I have who are working now. One of my former students is working at Red Hat. He's a kernel engineer. And one of my former students is working at Lincoln Labs. One of my students is a full stack developer now at a healthcare firm. So I do have kids that will take my training, my knowledge, and they'll bring it to their jobs, their colleges, and their careers beyond. So that's very gratifying. But you can't sort of make everybody a blue team, red team kind of person. That's just not what I'm trying to do.
That's fair. You know, I'm curious to understand from you, especially given an experience I recently had. I was at a Chief Information Security Officer Summit hosted by KKR, and the discussion came up that in the room, there were only 3 women versus all men in that whole event. And we were talking about diversity and how to encourage more diversity in the field of cybersecurity. I'm curious if there are things you think that companies and organizations can do to make cybersecurity more accessible and approachable to students, especially to encourage more diversity in the workforce for the next generation that's coming into the workforce.
Well, I have to give a big shout out to the two organizations I mentioned earlier, both us. The CSTA is the Computer Science Teachers Association, and also cyber.org. Both of them have had a tremendous, not just to make the diversity of the classroom students reflect the world at large, but have the teacher workforce look like that. At the CSTA conference that just concluded in Chicago this past summer, they had diversity groups. They had Latinx teachers. They had LGBTQ teachers. They had Black excellence was a trending. They had over 100 teachers of Black color teachers who were there being role models to the kids. Obviously, as a person who looks like me, I have to bring in those kinds of role models into the classroom. I have a wall of fame in the back of my classroom where I have different people that are being pictured. And it's not just Black men or Black women. I have other nationalities. I have other groups of kids that are here that represent. We have 60 languages spoken in my classroom. So I can glance over and I see I have Mark Dean, the father of the ISA board, is a Black engineer, worked for IBM. I also have folks that I've met through my life, people that I respect who are professors. This is a woman named Scott, who's known as an iPad developer, who's also a Victoria's Secret model. Kloss, who was on Coding with Kloss, she's a woman who is a model, who actually encourages young women to go into programming. Cyber.org has a Project Reach, I believe it's called, and they partner with high schools and feed students to the HBCUs that have cybersecurity programs. So that's one thing that we're doing. You see in the organizations, not just trying to make the classroom more reflective in terms of the students who are in there and having the curriculum that appeals to them, and has those cultural relevant links to it, but also making the teacher workforce more diverse. And that's a very difficult, very, very difficult problem, because a lot of people aren't going into teaching. And having the roles of having a Black male educator in the classroom having impact beyond just diversity, in a sense, because a lot of times the kids need to have role models that they can see and say, if they can do it, I can do it. So that's a challenge that we have as teachers, is to make sure that we have our classrooms as accommodating as possible. Getting back to the curriculum, for example, I teach awk and grep as something I do with part of my Linux thing. And I could have any kind of text. The kids can look at any kind of text. Well, I had my students looking at the I Have a Dream speech. How often does the word Georgia appear? And these are seminal documents in American history, the I Have a Dream speech, the Gettysburg Address, and you can use these text tools, the processing tools in Linux, to look at them. Well, then I have my students bring in their own information, bring in their own lyrics, bring in their own poetry, their own literature that they would see either in their own lives or something they got out of school, like the Langston Hughes poem. And I try to make that curriculum to them relevant. We showed the Coded Bias video, which was Babair, who's at MIT's Media Lab, and talks about how facial recognition didn't see Black faces the same way it see white faces. So try to make that curriculum really appeal to their own sense of identity. I think that's really some of my triumph, hopefully, with these kids, to say that, hey, the people who don't look like me could be very successful in computer science, bringing in those role models into the classroom, bringing in my former students who look like those kids were 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, and tell them, hey, I did this now. I went to UMass Boston. I went to Wentworth. I went to another school, and I'm working in the field right now. That really helps as well.
So as an educator, and especially since you're the founder of the Cybersecurity Educators Group, I would love to understand, what are some key conversations that educators are having related to cybersecurity today, and what are some areas of focus for them?
Wow, there's a lot going on. People want to know, if I build a lab, what should it look like? What kind of materials should I have in there? What kind of products do I bring in to make this look like a good lab? I mean, it's not a programming room, so it has to have different kinds of resources. I have, in my own room, I have my own dedicated servers. I have my own hubs, and I have my own Wi-Fi router. I can do things here. I can make an independent sandbox network so we can actually do cyber attacks within the classroom. That's kind of cool. People are asking about what kind of curriculum they should use. There's a lot, like I said earlier, there's stuff that people build themselves. There's a lot of stuff that people borrow. Code High School, Project Lead the Way. There's a lot of different products that are out there, and people want to know, like, what works for you, what doesn't work for you. How does it integrate with our different learning management systems like Canvas or Noodle, Google Classroom? There's a lot of these electronic tools to make your job as a teacher for grading a little bit easier or more in step with what the rest of the school wants. There's a lot of people asking about certifications. If I want my students, we have an innovation pathway here, cybersecurity innovation pathway. So we want our students out of a high school to have some sort of recognized certification. Is that something where the Juniper Networks has something, or do we go with CompTIA, or do we go with something that one of the vendors sometimes has their own certification? There's that kind of need to see that the kids can actually accomplish a goal of getting something that they can use as part of their resume to get a job out of high school. We want to see more of that vocational sort of bent on this. Or can they partner with, say, for example, a community college? So this kid's taking my course, credit towards college. Sometimes that's available. So really, there's a lot of people who post lesson plans that they do there. I post everything under some sort of copyleft copyright. If I write something, I put it up there, you can use it. Whether it's current events, stories, for example, in the lead up to the last presidential election, there was a lot of cybersecurity stories that we were there. With the war in Ukraine and Russian invasion of Ukraine, there was a lot of talk about what cyber warfare was going to look like. There was a lot of disinformation articles, the Colonial Pipeline, banks, all these ransomwares. There's not a day that goes by where there's not current events that go through the news cycles. So I try to bring, a lot of people are bringing those kind of stories. Like, how do you teach this? What kind of movies or videos do you show in the classroom? The Imitation Game or something to that effect. Are there any good websites? Are there good podcasts that we can listen to? So really, with 1,500 some odd members, is a real diversity of interests and a diversity of questions. And not everybody's a high school teacher. Some people are teaching third and fourth graders. How do you deal with that kind of, it's a very different kind of need that they have compared to a high school student.
So there's this concern that a lot of people have today that there's a shortage of cybersecurity talent in the industry today. My personal views on that are slightly different. I personally don't think there's a shortage in the industry. I think there's a hiring problem, but would love to understand from you, what is your perspective on the talent that's available in the market today? And are there things we can do earlier in people's education to deal with this in the future?
I've been hearing stories about we have 500,000 open jobs in STEM technology, 700,000 jobs in cyber, how many jobs in IT programming, yada, yada, yada. That's been going on for a while. So how do you cultivate those needs with the talent that's at hand? Part of it, I think, is that most companies, they don't know what the heck I'm doing in my high school kids. They have no clue that I have really talented, committed, bright young men and women who may speak three or four languages. Some of them do, who'd be really great if you would hire them now out of high school and mentor them, because you're going to get a fabulous employee. I think if you wait till they get to college and have a hiring fair for juniors and seniors, you're kind of a little bit late. I was told by one of my colleagues at the Cyber Education Discovery Forum in Alexandria just this past summer that he has students getting out of his high school being paid $70,000 a year to start doing IT and cyber work for companies in his area. And I'm like, wow, that sounds great. I wish my kids understood that they are able to do that. But I think you have to have those mentoring opportunities. You have to have those partnerships that really say, hey, these kids that we have in these high schools, if you really want good talent, you can get them out of high school and you can train them. I mean, I don't have an IT degree, but I worked in IT for 10, 15 years. A lot of it was self-taught. A lot of it was company paid training. And my natural curiosity got me where I was. So there is a lot of talent out there. I do think there is a hiring issue. If you have only AI-driven resume scanners, you're not really talking to a person. You're looking at a piece of paper. And there are people out there who know how to write a good resume who are not talented. And there are people who are very talented who can't write a resume. So what do? We have to. I always thought it was kind of bizarre when I got hired and they said, I'm going to ask you the same seven questions as these other people. You know, I understand that. I get it that that's the way your company does it. But you're not hiring a thing. You're hiring a person. And I think the human element is so critical, especially to what we do. In information technology, cybersecurity, it's a big human element. You have to be able to work with other people. I did some training. We spent the week at Google's headquarters in Cambridge. And the engineering director was asked, David Vintner was asked, like, what is the most important thing you have for somebody you hire here at Google? And without a moment's hesitation, he said, collaboration skills. And I bring that message to my kids. I said, not one person wrote Microsoft Word. Not one person wrote Google whatever. It's written by teams of people from all different backgrounds all over the world. And if you can't collaborate with somebody, you can be very brilliant, but no one's going to want to work with you. It's sort of a team effort. If you look at the people who play in a team, everybody has to do their jobs together. A baseball team, you have a pitcher, you have a catcher, you have this done, that one. They each have a job to do. And if they work well together, you could do something special. And I think that's the message that we have to look at with software development, with IT, cyber, that it's a team effort with different people, with different backgrounds and different interests. And if they can work well together, you can do something really cool. And it's a lot of fun. I think people don't understand that computer stuff is a blast. There's always something new going on. There's always something exciting. You're always going to have an opportunity to learn new things and meet people who are very interesting, who have all kinds of hobbies and ideas. And there's some pretty crazy people out there who are doing some really wonderful things. You don't know until you actually go out and meet them.
Well, Neil, one last question for you before we let you go. When you're not teaching and when you're not being an educator, what do you do for fun yourself outside of work?
I have two cats that that are very friendly. I like to go to Celtics games. I've been a Celtics season ticket holder for over 20 years now. With my son and my wife, we go to games. We go to hockey games that our little kids are playing, baseball games. We get to travel. We went to Toronto for a summer break. We went to a baseball game there. We went to the Hockey Hall of Fame. We went to a professional soccer game. We also went to Chinatown. We went to a botanical gardens, went to a bookstore. But, you know, I always said, if I go someplace, I don't want to just go to the beach. I want to go see how the people live there. That to me is the most fascinating thing, is actually going to other parts and seeing how other people live. You know, I could, if I go travel someplace new, I don't want to just go see the sights. I want to see, go to a restaurant, people live, hanging out, see what they're up to, and go to some music, listen to live concerts, go to a bar. I remember being in a little pub in Dublin and people saying, where are you from? Oh, Boston. Oh, our most Western province. And it's just that kind of experience where you actually get to interact with people from different parts of the world. We go to we go to zoos. We've gone to the zoo in Dublin. We've gone to the zoo in Amsterdam. I've been to a zoo in other parts of the world, aquariums. It's just, I went to an aquarium in Norway, of all places. It's just that the kind of stuff, you know. I guess I don't have one interest. So a couple of different things going on.
I have two follow-ups based on that answer. Number one is, what's the next place that you're hoping to visit that you haven't been to?
Well, I am going to Southampton in England. We're going to go try to take a tour of the Premier League stadium and take a ship from there to New York. But that's planned. I don't care. I really, my wife says, hey, let's go to Asia. Okay, I'm down. I like going to cities all around. We're probably going to try to go someplace during April break within an hour and a half from where I live. And, we go to find a bookstore, I'll go to a bookstore. If we go to a zoo, I'll go to the zoo. Whatever it is, just to get out of town and see something different.
My second follow-up question is, what are the name of your cats? What type of cats are they and how old are they?
Robin and Homer, they're brothers. We got them during the pandemic. They're about 2 years old when we got them. Bonded brothers. We had my wife many years ago. She said, oh, Neil, we're getting a cat. Her mom was getting rid of a cat. So I never had a cat growing up. So we had Patches joined us, and she was an old cranky lady, but she was lived in our house. And then she passed the Rainbow Bridge, they call it. We had two cats that were given to us from other people. And then we had Frasier, who we had for 17 years. And these guys we've had now for about 4 years. Robin invariably sleeps by my feet every night, and Homer jumps in me, tells me to wake up, time to feed me. But I like dogs too. My mother-in-law has a dog. You know, other people have dogs, but they're more work. You'd have to take them for walks. You have to do other things. Cats, you can leave them. They're easy to take care of. But that's part of, one of my students said after the pandemic, we came back to in-person teaching, and he said, I miss seeing your cat, because the cat would visit me during Zoom teaching. So.
Yeah, I also have two cats, so I had to put them away and close the door. Otherwise, they would be in here crawling all over the place. So love to hear about more cats. Well, Neil, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure, and look forward to learning more from you in the future.
Thank you. It's been a blast as well. And I hope if you have any questions, follow up, hit me up. I'd be more than happy to help share what I know.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. If you want to join us as a guest on the podcast or have a recommended guest, please email us at podcast@netspy.com. Until next time.